Hello, lilt lovers of liberty. It is April 28, and this is Liberty Southwest, podcast number 12. And we have tonight Eric Taylor, Danny Ning, Chelsea Camo, and Kirk Pettis. And I think we're going to start out with a little foreign policy talk. Eric, you want to lead into it?
Sure. I don't know if you guys are aware of, there's been over the last week or so, there have been a series of drone strikes that the U.S. military has conducted in Yemen to root out some of the more senior al-Qaeda leadership that allegedly are there. I have a few clips that kind of go over, you know, what's been going on there. I don't know if you guys like to discuss this at all before I play the clips, or if I should just roll it and discuss afterwards.
Is this, have they killed someone around 50 total, or is it just one attack? I thought it was just something about that.
A couple attacks, and the numbers are high. I don't know if it's 50, but it's around there. They've certainly they've killed quite a few al-Qaeda, and I think, you know, as well as civilians too, from what I've read and what I've seen on various clips.
Yeah, take it away.
All right, so I'll go ahead and play this clip. It's pretty short, a little under 2 minutes.
Well, John, in other news, an update on the drone strikes in Yemen that killed dozens of al-Qaeda fighters. Right now we're working on finding out who exactly was killed in these drone strikes, as the Obama administration is now facing a court order to release secret memos on using drones to kill Americans suspected of terrorism overseas. Our chief intelligence correspondent, Catherine Harris, is live in Washington with more on this story. Catherine?
Well, thank you, Jenna. A Yemeni government official confirming to Fox News a short time ago that the recent propaganda video released by al-Qaeda in Yemen, which got a lot of play last week, was a gold mine for intelligence, revealing the faces of operatives, identifying their vehicles, even the license plates, and the location in the rugged mountains of southern Yemen, an area that is largely outside the government's control and similar to the lawless tribal areas of Pakistan. The Yemeni government source says the video was a total miscalculation by al-Qaeda in Yemen, helping the security forces narrow the focus of the operation, which came in three waves over the weekend. This is the first time that Yemeni security forces trained by U.S. counterterrorism teams have carried out night raids with the support of U.S. airstrikes. Fox News has also told this morning that the target was not the leadership of al-Qaeda in Yemen, which includes Nasser al-Wahashi, a longtime aide to Osama bin Laden. You see him there on the right. Nor the bomb maker Ibrahim al-Assiri, who was behind the failed underwear bomb plot in 2009. This source emphasizing that the two men do not travel with the large groups of recruits and go to great lengths to avoid the training camps, which are an obvious target for counterterrorism strikes. This Yemeni government official also explaining the operation was designed to break up the support network for AQAP and the recruitment network. They had intelligence that they were preparing an attack on an oil facility where foreign nationals work, Jenna.
Interesting, Catherine. Thank you.
You're welcome.
The Supreme Court hearing arguments right now.
So that's the first clip, kind of going over how the various al-Qaeda operatives were identified, which was probably a little sloppy on their part, and, you know, the fact that they were identified and taken out. I don't know if you guys have any thoughts on that either way, or...
Go
ahead, Danny.
I don't know. My thought is, you know, it seems like every time I hear news about, you know, we have these drone strikes, we're taking out leaders and leaders about, you know, these are the right-handed men of Osama bin Laden. It sounds like there's already like dozens of these guys. So sometimes I'm like, is this made up stuff? You know, I don't know. To me, it sounds like it's just an excuse that, you know, we just want to bomb the hell out of people.
Yeah, and I have another clip that really kind of relates to what you're talking about. It's an RT clip. I'll play that up. We can talk about it a little bit and then move on to another topic here. So this kind of – Kirko's 55, I guess, people who are killed. This clip touches on that a little bit.
Although drone strikes have waned in Pakistan, make no mistake that America's drone war continues with full force. Over the course of the last 3 days, several U.S. drone strikes hit southern Yemen, killing as many as 55 people and perhaps the deadliest weekend since the advent of drone warfare. Although U.S. government officials have not made any statements in connection to the bombings, Yemen's Interior Ministry described the actions as unprecedented. The aerial bombing campaign was said to have targeted an al-Qaeda militant training camp in the al-Baida region. But of course, using the blanket term militant is very convenient when discussing mass casualties by way of unmanned drones. Because as we know, being of, quote, military age is all the criteria necessary to be labeled as a militant or enemy combatant by the CIA. And once someone is labeled as such, the judge, jury, and executioner takes the form of a machine. Considering how these bombings also struck a passing civilian vehicle, it's eerily reminiscent to another drone strike from last December, which mistakenly targeted a wedding party, killing 15. Keep in mind that according to the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, quote, drones have killed as many as 451 people in Yemen, including as many as 82 civilians. Once again, accurate civilian casualty numbers are nearly impossible to know because these people were never given a chance to defend themselves in a court of law. Not to mention the abysmal 2% success rate at killing actual high-level targets. But aside from the civilian deaths, America's expanding drone war in Yemen calls attention to another troubling aspect of the global war on terror, the targeted killing of U.S. citizens. Yes, I'm talking about the case of Anwar al-Awlaki, a New Mexico man who was targeted and killed by a U.S. drone strike in Yemen in 2011. And just weeks later, his son, 16-year-old American citizen Abdul Raham, was also incinerated via drone along with his cousin. Ever since, activists have been fighting for some semblance of transparency about why the American teen had to die. Well, just this week, a New York federal appeals court called for the release of a classified memo supposedly providing a legal justification for the execution. The ruling follows several FOIA lawsuits by the New York Times and ACLU, which call into question the legality of Obama's targeted killing program. In a response to the most recent ruling, Jamil Jaffer, an ACLU attorney, added that, quote, the government can't pretend that everything about its targeted killing program is a classified secret, while senior officials selectively disclose information meant to paint the program in the most favorable light. Yes, while the Joint Chiefs of Staff huddle around on Terror Tuesdays picking out new targets from the stack of baseball cards, all the public hears that al-Qaeda is being defeated. But the ACLU statement is especially important considering how an overwhelming number of academic papers have concluded that every single non-combatant death only fuels the recruitment of potential enemies. In other words, drone strikes are creating terrorists. Further proof of this is that the failure of drone strikes in Pakistan have led to the U.S. now officially negotiating with the Taliban. So with a bloated military budget needed to justify its exponential growth, the war on terror has officially become nothing more than a self-fulfilling prophecy.
So
pretty shameful.
So I guess I'm just still kind of confused. Like, what is the objective for, you know, sending these drones out to, because, you know, how long have this been going on, and what is the result of this? You know, we still, like, I'm still kind of pondering, like, what are the results from, you know, sending these drones out, killing all these al-Qaeda people or, you know, civilians, and, you know, what has this done? What any good has this done for us so far? I'm guessing that's my question.
It's protected our interests throughout the globe. The Empire, we have to strike back.
The Empire strikes back, right?
Yeah, it's I find very little evidence of being hurt in, you know, continental United States and or Alaska and Hawaii, but the growing trend is, and I wish I had the clip of it, but Ricky Rubio was all lambasting, I think I talked about this last time, that all the new terrorists are going to be coming out of Syria because it's the hotbed of, you know, terrorists, and the government has lack of control in certain areas, and I think we're over there even fostering that. So I think it's pretty proven, actually, that we're over there fostering that. We're helping out these rebels and Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups. And it's pretty shameful. So on one hand, we're helping them. And on the other hand, when they get out of line, apparently, when they go beyond their needs of our empire, our foreign interests, or our interests in foreign lands, then apparently we got to take them out. And I think we've seen that with Gaddafi, Saddam Hussein, and others of the sort. I mean, Gaddafi was a good friend of many American politicians here and a supporter of ours, and we just went out there over there and ousted him. But I wonder, I think Eric's audio cut out on him there. But it's like,
there can you
we
hear
go,
me now?
Getting that
I'm back.
Repeat back.
Yeah, I'm back. Can you guys hear me?
Yeah, but it's, we can hear you.
I have a question for
more
Kurt,
terrorists. All right, Eric, what were you saying?
When Ricky Rubio was addressing Syria, did he get any assists or anything along those lines?
I don't know, because I didn't read the clip or hear the clip. I just heard him make it. I just saw the headlines of it and was pretty disgusted about it, since he is sits on the chairs committee, or I don't think he chairs, but he's on the Foreign Intelligence Committee, and he obviously has a lot more insider knowledge than the public at large. So what he is he's following the mantra of the State Department. So that was my example then, that, you know, Ricky Rubio is all in with the State Department, and so he's going to get the backing of the shadow government in a way.
You know who I think Ricky Rubio is really in with?
Who?
Flip Saunders, point guard for the Timberwolves.
Marco Rubio. I say that every time.
I was like, what the heck are you talking about?
I'm covering my bases. So
that's what I was asking about. That's why I was asking about assists.
Ricky Rubio has made some big stances. When I run into him time to time, he goes off on foreign policy. Marco Rubio, my bad.
Did Ricky Rubio get some assists? Well, you better did.
Bet he did.
Yeah, I don't know. This is just outrageous how we're still doing this, using these drones. And you know, I haven't even really heard much about these drones going out to Yemen or Saudi Arabia and all that, killing all the innocents. It's just the fact that, you know, I'm not sure if people just don't care anymore, but, you know, I'm just kind of sick of seeing the media about talking about that Donald Sterling be making racist comments, you know. These things, like, it doesn't even matter. It's like, you know, there's people's lives at stake, and, you know, we don't even hear about it. And, I don't know, it just upsets me a little bit. And, you know, because of this, you know, Obama will continue these strikes for, you know, just trying to take out targets to meet his agenda, whatever that is. So, I don't know.
Well, it leads us to, you know, it kind of suggests that the media isn't there to inform us of what's going on a daily basis. They're there to push whatever agenda that might be, which is why we don't hear about India elections, which is why we might hear about silly stories to distract us. Why they talk about someone making a racist comment or having an affair on their wife instead of talking about actual events going on around the world that are of significant importance to the American public.
With that, would you like to talk
about...
That's
a good segue into that India election.
The India elections.
Well, I could lead it into a little bit. Last night, John Oliver started his program on HBO. It's called Last Week Tonight or something of the sort. I guess I should know. But it's a little news, half-hour news show that covers everything from the last week till the new show. So it's, he obviously left the Daily Show probably for this show, and I don't know, he was fairly entertaining, even though I don't see the eye to eye very much with John Oliver, but I think he attacks the media like kind of we do, so kind of a, I guess the clip will show that.
Is it kind of the, John Oliver is kind of the wacky political guy off of the Jon Stewart show, right?
Yeah, there's going to be a few Effenheimers maybe rolling through this clip, but
yeah, because he kind of he kind of replaced Colbert, I think, didn't he? After he left, and they both have their own shows. Or Colbert, isn't he going? Isn't he replacing Letterman?
I think he's taking over Letterman. Yeah,
yeah. So Jon Stewart's like the Bill Walsh of political or talk show hosts. Okay, I'll play this clip.
It's a little long. We can stop and play. Maybe if you want to keep your hand on pause, if we want to chime in.
Okay.
Is the 2016 field shaping up?
The prospects of Hillary Clinton,
Vice President Joe Biden,
Chris Christie leading the way.
Maybe it can actually be Jeb Bush.
Rand Paul is one of the leading front runners.
Ted Cruz even saw it. Donald Trump.
Could he be testing the presidential waters again?
I've got an even more important question. Who gives a shit? Because here is the frustrating thing. Cable news does not need to be focusing on an election that is happening in 926 days when there's an important one happening right now that they are all completely ignoring.
The world's biggest election is underway in India.
It's the biggest election on the planet.
814 million voters eligible to vote.
Yeah, the biggest election in human history is taking place in India right now. Nearly one-fifth of the world's working age population lives there. It has a direct economic impact on America, and yet this is the most substantive conversation about it that we could find.
Well, we're going to get questions from some writers to the program saying, what are you talking about India for? What does that have to do with the United States?
850 million voters.
Right. I mean, why should that concern us? They're not even in our hemisphere.
Even in our hemisphere, and if they're not, they basically don't exist. See? Look, they're not even on my globe. They're not on my globe. Show me where they are. You can't, can you, boy? But look. At least the guy from Six Flags.
Do you want to pause it for a second, Eric?
Sure. Okay.
Yeah, so that's, to me, that was shocking. I have not even heard about the India election. Have you guys before?
I heard a little bit about it.
Yeah, no, I was thinking about India food, but no, not elections.
What's going on over there, Kirk?
It's just they're labeling it as, you know, the biggest election ever. So it's kind of a, I don't know if it's a huge deal or whatnot, but it's you know, it is the most, is it, I don't know, do they have more population than China? I think they do, don't they? They have over a billion citizens.
I don't know. Maybe. There might be a little more than China now, because China is about 1.3 billion. India might be a little more, yeah. For some reason, you might be correct on that.
Yeah, so, well,
it's 1 trillion people at the end of 2013.
1 trillion?
1 trillion. 1 billion, you mean?
Yeah, 1 billion. Yeah, sorry, 1 billion.
They've got some good population growth going on.
Yeah.
Okay. So China's still higher then.
There's, well, here's what's funny is, all right, let's listen to the rest of the clip that,
you want me to continue?
Yeah, the style of the campaigning and the two candidates he gets into, it'll shed a little more light on the situation.
All right, here we go.
Because the Indian election is not even that complicated. Just like in American elections, all it really comes down to is two people.
There are two key people fighting this out. Rahul Gandhi from the Congress Party and Narendra Modi from the BJP.
Okay, great. So let's deal with Gandhi first. And I'll realise that it is not the first time that sentence has been said in a British accent. But put that aside. There's no time. Rahul Gandhi, however, is, wow, that guy is handsome. Look at that vest. He's like an Indian Han Solo. This guy is the total political package. He's got good looks. He's from a family with three former prime ministers. He's got that vest. With those three credentials, you'd think he'd have this thing completely locked up by now. But in the kind of twist worthy of at least a modicum of cable news coverage, he's actually widely expected to lose the election to this guy.
Narendra Modi is a leader of India's Hindu Nationalist Party.
There's a growing wave of support behind Narendra Modi, a hard man politician who's worked his way up from the bottom. As a boy, he sold tea on a railway station.
Modi sold tea in a railway station, and now he's the most popular man in the country. Don't pretend you're not interested in this, America. The last time you heard a rags-to-riches story about a tea-selling Indian kid, you threw a fucking Oscar at it. And you love that more than the curious case of Benjamin Button. And come on! He starts as an old man and he ends as a dead baby. It's a heartwarming tale. Watch it again. Watch it again. That's not the point. The point is, Modi has managed to inspire people with his populist platform, including a pledge to put toilets in every home. And, wow, that's a bold move, coming out as pro-toilet. Finally, someone's taking on the powerful, hastily dug ditch in a field lobby. Now, this is both funny and also incredibly important as a public health issue. But if that wasn't enough, in a move that I cannot believe no American politician has tried, Modi has been making campaign appearances via hologram. That's right. Modi has gone Tupac at Coachella. And that is how you convince. That is how you convince.
All right, you want to stop it, Eric? Probably all right. It's estimated that they're going to spend $5 billion US dollars in India, the equivalent of $5 billion, which is on that presidential election over there. Which is pretty high when it's three times higher than their last time they had a presidential election.
Well, I think there's 100 million more voters that came on board this time around.
Yeah.
So a lot of it's the administration of taking the tallies and all of that stuff. But
how funny is it that Modi is doing hologram speeches around the country? That's something we're not used to.
Is it like the hologram, like Darth Vader type of hologram that you see in Star Wars?
Yes. That's why he John Oliver compared it to Tupac, where Tupac did a concert when it was all just him as a hologram.
Nice. That would be kind of cool to see. So if you see like a hologram of Obama, would you vote for him? It's like, oh, this is cool.
Well, when you have over 800 million voters, I mean, it's pretty tough to go around and do as much face-to-face conversation or whatnot. So it's the hologram's actually a pretty brilliant idea for a country so large as India. And but that's kind of a unpersonal, and I don't know, it's just kind of a scary way for politicians to end up leading to, even though that scratching noise Danny's big time back.
All right. I'm just rocking my leg for some reason.
So it makes it very impersonal, I guess. When we're at our these committees or conferences we've gone to, you know, a lot of politicians, when they're not in town that want to be there, they send a video in, you know, and it's nice to see them have their support or whatnot, but it's definitely nothing like anyone there in person. So it's there's plus and minuses to a hologram, but it definitely does get your message out, especially when so much of India is so much in poverty that I don't know how many people have televisions or whatnot, or what's the best way to get it? I have no idea, but.
Well, they said that up until recently, only about 10% of the population, so basically just the elite, had access to the internet. And so now we're seeing this huge surge of the Indian population that's finally getting access to the internet, but not the way that we saw it in America, where we got computers and then we got, you know, dial up and then it, you know, went on. And now we have smartphones and everything else. Over there, it sounds like the majority of the population went right to smartphones, and they're just now really starting to get access to different modes of information and different sources like we've had for the past, you know, 10, 20 years. So they're appealing to a younger audience as well.
Yeah, the problem is, though, India has such a slum population that so many of their population lives in slums that country needs to see some infrastructure work, and I don't know if it should happen through the government or not. Maybe, you know, for this Modi guy to promise a toilet in every home or whatnot, that's quite an undertaking, and I don't see how India could even pay for it. But
is that somewhat of a socialist policy too?
I would think so, especially with the current infrastructure. But it has to start at some point. I mean, if it's a health thing. I mean, look at America, how a lot of diseases just started to vanish once we had better plumbing and sewer systems and water systems, clean water. And I mean, the way people live in the slums is, it's pretty disturbing, and shows a lot to the immunity of the human body. But, you know, I'm not that educated in it. I don't know much about either candidate. You know, John makes it seem there's one more is more on the elite side, and the other guy is definitely more on the, I guess in America it'd be the Republican versus Democrat, but I don't really know enough to say either way, but it's, I don't know. What do you guys think about a politician promising a toilet in every house?
Well, I think it says a lot about the state of India, but the other thing that I just thought was so interesting about this in general was just the fact that the largest vote or the largest election in human history, and our U.S. channels aren't even covering it. And it will have major impacts on the United States, so it's not as though it's inconsequential. And the fact that I just heard about it yesterday and it's already going on.
Yeah, I think there was an election in Afghanistan recently. Or no, it's coming up. But, you know, we do hear of other elections. It's not like we are blind to all foreign elections. So I would say there's a reason they're not reporting it then, and I wonder what that reason is.
I'm guessing my question is, with these elections, how does it really affect us? Does it affect us in one shape or form? Are there, like, is one candidate over the other, you know, does he support the U.S., whether it's trade or politics or whatever. I guess I'm not quite sure. I haven't heard much about this. So,
well, I guarantee we are supporting either both of them in a sense, but I guarantee we're trying to sway the election one way or the other. And it's just surprising not to hear about it. The complete ignoring of it, it's pretty amazing, but because it does have drastic impacts. I mean, they're a major center in that area, a major center for trade. And, smack dab in between the Middle East and China.
Yeah, that's fair. Is Eric out? Eric?
I'm here.
Okay. Well, this could be another segue to another topic. Are there anything you guys want to discuss more about this India election? When is this over, or is this kind of no, I don't think it's over. When is the exact?
It's ongoing. Well, yeah, it's ongoing now. We've got it go through like a few different phases, and it's going on for the next few weeks, I believe.
April 7th, okay. 12th.
It'll be finalized May 16th, it says.
And May 16th.
It started April 7th, I guess.
Okay.
They have like a little over a month of some kind of election type thing, so.
And they certainly have a lot more, or many more political parties than in the United States that are, you know, successful.
Yeah, and it's surprising that there's only two candidates running for the head seat. Is it even for president? What is it? It's a parliamentary, but...
Prime Minister.
Prime Minister.
Yeah.
But yeah, well, half the reason I wanted to bring up is surprising that, you know, I haven't heard about it or none of us really had heard about it. And then, I don't know, John Oliver's stance on just kind of making fun of the media, I think it's... might be a good show, but it just shows the segment, because John Oliver is definitely more on the liberal side of the aisle, and for him to be blasting both sides of the media is pretty it's pretty nice. And I think that's the growing trend, and that's why when we talked about Rand Paul before, I think that his numbers will do very well from just by his libertarian stance that transcends both parties. And it's as long as Rand Paul's critical mass numbers are there, he won't be able to be stopped.
So do either of you think that Gandhi or Modi will make a significant difference either way? I mean, if whoever's elected, if you guys observed, you know, what looked to be the results of either one winning, or?
Well, I want to say there's definitely a kind of class system in India.
Yeah, it's a caste system.
A caste system. And so it's, for him to pander, to say there's a toilet, that's completely unfeasible. So I don't know about this guy. What we didn't listen to is Modi when he was, I want to say, in control of this town, and if he was a mayor or a governor of a quadrant or something, there was a massive uprising when a lot of people got killed, and it was predominantly Muslims that got killed.
And it was like 1,000 people, and they asked him about his greatest regret. About what had happened, and he said his greatest regret was that he didn't handle the media better, which is actually kind of ironic when you consider how this was brought about.
Yeah, so it seems more like he's more of the socialist candidate that just says whatever it takes to get elected, and he might not be that trustworthy of a guy. I really don't know, and I don't know. But the other guy definitely seems to be coming from the ruling class, so it's... And for how India is set up, I mean, for the lack of infrastructure they have, that's a town measure that just is never remediated. I mean, I've seen the garbage piles that are just line areas that Indians spend, you know, just dig through trash constantly, and the slums are just horrendous, and I don't know what you can do besides going back to more and more freedom, and I don't know if either of these candidates recommend more freedom and for other people to arise and start their own businesses or whatnot. Because if there's a class system and the corruption that breeds, businesses have a tough time to be related, because you need the connections and then the constant mob mentality of the shakedown is usually what follow suit with that. So it makes it very tough for small businesses to be created if they're not in the inner sanctum, so to say. But It'll just be interesting, and it's just surprising that the State Department and our media hasn't made anything, any relevations towards it, because there's no way our State Department is not being involved over there with our Council of Foreign Relations and the State Department, what they do in other countries, especially during elections. So we're definitely being involved, and we're kept in the dark, just kind of like these drone attacks we were talking about earlier.
Yep. So, Danny, I think you had a topic you wanted to touch on. What do you have? What do you have going with that?
I've just kind of came across something while at work, just kind of reading about the IRS since tax season was just over. But basically, it just states how just all these people who works in the IRS who are not paying taxes yet somehow. They're paying their share of taxes, and yet they are getting all these bonuses and things like that. So there's a clip that I found in YouTube to just kind of touch base on that. So yeah, feel free to you can play that right now.
All right,
have that ready.
Yep.
Marley?
Elizabeth, thanks. New fuel for critics of the IRS this morning. Government investigators say the tax agency doled out millions of dollars in bonuses to workers with disciplinary issues. That includes some who did not pay their own taxes. Nancy Cortez is on Capitol Hill, where there are demands for change. Nancy, good morning.
Good morning, Charlie. That's right. They owed money to the federal government, and yet they were still getting extra money from the government in the form of bonuses. And perhaps what's most surprising here is that this is all completely in line with federal regulations.
Internal watchdogs at the IRS found that over the course of 2 years, 2,800 employees who had been disciplined for misconduct also received bonuses worth more than $2.8 million. The infractions included late payment or non-payment of federal taxes, misuse of travel cards, even fraud. The problem, the report points out, is that the IRS does not consider tax compliance or other misconduct when issuing performance awards. In fact, government-wide policies do not provide guidance on providing awards to employees with conduct issues. California Republican Daryl Issa, who chairs the House Oversight Committee, says that needs to change.
In the private sector, you don't get bonuses, pay increases, and promotions right after you've done something wrong. And that's what's really wrong with the culture there. At a minimum, people should have a timeout from bonuses and promotions after being found doing something wrong. That should be inherently part of the punishment.
The questionable bonuses were only a small fraction of the $86 million in extra cash the IRS gave to its employees in 2012. But they're a source of fresh outrage for those still steaming over the agency's admission in 2013 that some Tea Party groups were singled out for extra scrutiny.
There's no question this is part of a problem in the federal government, that money is spent like it's somebody else's, because it is.
And part of the problem is that these bonuses are written into the contracts between the government and unions for these IRS workers. So they're very difficult to claw back when there's misconduct. They're practically part of a worker's salary. 70% of IRS workers get some form of bonus. The IRS says it is working to change the system, and it should have some answers, Nora, by June. All right, Nancy.
They say 70% of the contracts have bonuses written in.
That's what I heard too. So, man, yeah. What the hell am I doing in my current job? I should work for the IRS.
That's usually around 50% in the private sector.
Well, I mean, I don't get any bonuses. And, if I do my job wrong, there's a good chance that I'll get fired.
Well, why are they giving? I mean, I can see how it's written in the contract, but so it's. It's a line item in the budget then that they know they're going to give this bonus. But for how Democrats cry that the money is being siphoned away from government, yet we're giving bonuses to IRS employees, that it just boggles my mind that why aren't the contracts just written as such and not why are government employees getting bonuses? Do teachers get bonuses?
Sure.
Well, I mean, I have nothing wrong with bonuses, but I am under the understanding that bonuses are an incentive program for people to meet certain goals. So if you don't meet those goals, you don't get your bonus. If you don't have any strings attached to receiving a bonus, then they should just call it salary. Like, that's the entire point of a compensation structure, is that a bonus is supposed to incentivize someone to achieve, you know, or it, maybe it's a profit-sharing plan based on certain company goals, but it's devised as such to be an incentive plan, not a guaranteed payment. Guaranteed payments are like salaries and commissions and things.
Well, it'd be interesting to see the contracts, because the contracts might just say, hey, if you put in X amount of hours, you get a bonus. And that's why 70% of the people got a bonus.
Right.
They just show up for work.
Yep.
Well, and it was a good point that was mentioned, that they were treating as though they were spending other people's money, because they are. And that's part of the issue, right? I mean, there's not a real connection between the person that's supposedly receiving benefit, which would be, what, the American public, right? And, you know, and the people making the decisions for whether or not they qualify for a bonus.
Yeah.
You know, it's other people's money they're spending, and they act that way.
Yeah, they're spending taxpayer money for, you know, the crappy job they're doing. And, you know, them not paying taxes, yet they're still getting these bonuses. It's like, you know, if I'm not paying my taxes, I'll be going to jail. So, and, you know, but if you work for the IRS, if you don't pay your taxes, it seems like you're okay. You're like the upper echelon right there. I don't know.
Well,
no, you're not going to go to jail.
They just,
they said 8% of the population is behind on their taxes.
Yeah.
8% of the country. That's a substantial amount.
It
and
is.
Have you heard about how they're trying to... There are bills getting put forth in Congress to utilize private collection agencies to go after delinquent taxes. Have you guys heard about that?
No.
I can see that.
I haven't, but if they could do it at a better price point for the American taxpayer, I wouldn't totally be against it.
I'm against it. What we shouldn't – we all argue
I
that
the
taxes –
double standard, you know.
Well,
I'm just more upset by the double standards, where here's another example where, you know, the government all have all these rules and they apply to the citizens, but they don't apply to the people in government, you know. So like the Affordable Care Act applies to the citizens, but if you're part of Congress, then you don't have to participate. You know, it's just, once again, there are rules for the citizens themselves, and then there's rules for the government, and, which is really kind of an absence of rules.
I don't think it's different. I mean, I think it's easier to point at federal workers and why they're not paying their taxes, because for them to not pay their taxes mean they're not getting any deductions out of their taxes in the first place. Because
well, it doesn't mean
the majority of people
deductions,
getting salary.
Deductions shouldn't be an incentive. I mean...
No,
should.
I'm just saying that's why the majority of – if I guarantee if everyone didn't have deductions, taxes taken out of their paycheck, that 8% would be more like 45%.
Oh, I
and there would be a tax revolt in this country. The whole – but here's the other example, Chelsea, is that from one taxpayer preparer to another, you could be paying in a different amount. So it's not,
not
really
if you're
the
doing
laws
it correctly.
That are – Well, I would beg to differ. I think that it's
Well, and then you go and open the door as to whether somebody is going to be open to fraud or not. So, like, I don't participate in fraudulent tax returns, but I can guarantee that there are plenty of accountants out there who do. So, yeah, if by those means and liberties you'd say that you could come up with different numbers, then yes, I would agree.
Well, there's just so many laws you can't even know them all.
No,
it's
you can't,
either,
but you can get a good grip on an individual's economic transactions for a year.
Yes, but my point is if we wanted to have a fair law, the fairest way would just be a flat form of tax. And then
oh,
be,
I agree with you. If we had
it'd be
a
easier
flat
to point the finger and say
tax?
You're breaking the law, but
well, I mean, you wouldn't have an issue of tax evasion. If we had a flat tax law based on purchases, then there'd be A, no discrimination, B, no evasion, I mean, it would completely eliminate all of the issues that we have currently. And you wouldn't have to spend all these administrative costs trying to track people down and get them to pay their tax bill, or worry about people that are finding loopholes or maybe taking cash on the side and not reporting it, because it's not based on your income anymore. It's based on what you purchase through a store. And that point of purchase is where you pay your taxes. It would also increase transparency of what the total dollar amount is that you actually pay in taxes, because instead of being a little bit over here, a little bit over here, some for sales tax, some for income tax, some for self-employment tax, some taxes built into the products you already buy, instead you could really see the impact of our tax system on a purchase-by-purchase basis.
Yeah, that's the way I would lean towards. It's,
but that would get rid of the IRS, so that's never going to happen.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I mean, it threatens my particular field as well. But I'd be worth taking the hit if that's what it would take to make a better system.
Well, there'd be a lot more audits.
A lot of my job security goes away.
Just because you have a flat tax or a national sales tax doesn't mean there's not going to be fraud or anything either. The government still has to figure out how to collect that and how to record transactions that are, so there'd be, it'd open a whole new avenue of a way of auditing and such, but that's
besides the point.
Yeah. I think where you would see it more than would be in the hands of the merchant who is recording his sales and submitting the sales tax, because the dollar amounts would be much larger, and therefore there'd be a much higher incentive for the business owner to maybe not record some of the transactions that he received in cash or something.
Yes, that's exactly my point.
You know,
and
so
that way there'd be a lot more auditing.
Well, there would be a lower number of people to audit, because instead of every single individual plus every single company, you would just have to deal with companies, essentially.
I have a question for Danny and Chelsea. Do you think, when talking about flat tax or avoidance, that it's more significant on personal individual tax or corporate tax?
Do I think avoidance is greater with businesses or with individuals? Is that the question?
Yeah.
I would think it's, I would say both. But, you know, corporate taxes, I think corporates they're obviously larger companies, and a lot of corporates, they hire tax professionals that knows all the loopholes and deductions and things like that. Like, you know, in the past, like GE paid zero taxes because of all the deductions that they have and things like that that they could take. So I think corporate have a higher impact, because, you know, typically just simply because they're businesses, and individuals, I don't know. If lower income individuals, even if they kind of do some manipulations of their taxes, at the end of the day, they're still kind of small. It's somewhat immaterial. But you can also make the argument that, you know, a little number times a large number still always equals a big number. So in a way, kind of both. I kind of agree with what you said, Chelsea, that it's impact.
It's easier to point the finger at a corporation because they're going to have X amount of dollars that's so much larger than an individual will ever have.
I agree. I think that corporations have been demonized for a long time as being big bad wolves. And I'd say that individuals and companies are both probably not paying their, well, if you call it a fair share. I mean, There are a couple different ways that we could look at it. We could look at just strictly income taxes, or we could also talk about all the other taxes to which we're subject, both individually or as companies. We won't go down that road. But I believe that there's a fair amount of noncompliance in either way. It's just when you get to like really, really, really big corporations, then they have the means to employ teams and teams of people to either retrospectively adjust their deductions or to make decisions throughout the year that fit in with the current codes so that they can take advantage of the system, not in an illegal way, but in a very legal way. Because they have teams of people that say, if we make these strategic decisions with our dollars, then we can avoid tax. And there's a much bigger, there's a very distinguishable difference between, tax avoidance and tax evasion. Tax avoidance is 100% legal for every single person in the United States. It means that you're making smart decisions throughout the year to avoid having to pay certain taxes, meaning you might invest in a tax-deferred, you know, retirement account. That's tax avoidance, not tax evasion. Tax evasion is where you're not reporting your income or you're doing fraudulent things to evade taxes.
Yeah, but what's really the difference in the long run?
Well,
one is legal, one isn't.
Right.
Well, yeah, but so why we should be arguing as a liberty stance that it shouldn't even be set up this way in the first place at all, and that it's really
I agree.
Taxes
I
are
agree.
Foreign
I
mean, to the founding of America in a sense, and it's so intertwined that it's how.
If I were to argue against one, if I were to just get one argument for one tax out of the way, I would say that one thing that most people don't really think about very often that has just huge, huge, huge implications for America and private property is property tax. So, and I don't know if we've talked about this before or not, but just the very fact that we have property tax means that there's no such thing as private property in America. And we're led to believe that we can, you know, have that American dream. We can go and buy a home and buy land and we own it. It belongs to us, the American people. And the sad fact is that the second that you tie taxes to simply owning property is the second that that land is essentially owned by the government. Because if you stop paying your property tax bill, what happens? The government comes and takes that land and it doesn't belong to you anymore. So what you're really left with is perpetual rent of that property. You can only use it so long as you continue to pay your taxes every year. So what is that? That's rent. That's not ownership. It's just completely unconstitutional as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I would be okay if, you know, like if I buy a property and I have to pay tax the first transaction, I'd be okay with that. But yeah, like just on a continuous basis and just paying taxes every year, the same amount is, yeah, it's like, you know, you're really not owning the home. And, you know, if you, the moment you stop paying those taxes, you know, they'll take it away from you. So even if you put 100% all, even the property is 100% of it is all your equity. If you somehow can't afford to pay the taxes because you lost your job or something, oh well, you know, the government pretty much takes the house for free and, you know, do whatever they want with it. So it's just,
well, they'd put a lien on it and sell it and then give you the rest. But you're going to make pennies on the dollar because it's going to auction. But
right.
Well, and they take it from you. Exactly. And I mean, let's just imagine for a second. I mean, there was a while, this was when I was younger. I had the dream of kind of removing myself from the traditional society and saying, would it be possible for me to self-sustain on my own? Let's say I could come up with the money to buy a plot of land. And then I could grow my own food and, you know, burn, you know, wood in my fireplace. And so that I didn't need the infrastructure. I didn't need the, you know, the government or society for anything. If I could just live and completely provide for myself, I couldn't do it. I mean, with property taxes, I wouldn't be allowed to just buy a piece of land outright. In cash, here's your money, this is my land now, and I'm not going to ask anything from you ever again. I'm just going to live out here, and I'm going to have my vegetables, and then I'm going to can them so that I have food throughout the winter. I'm not allowed to do that because I still have to participate in society, because if I don't, I can't pay property taxes, and if I can't pay property taxes, that land is going to be confiscated.
Yeah, the closest you can get to that right now is the Free State Project in New Hampshire, but you still can't get around the property tax.
Well, what's going on out there?
Oh, there's been the Free State Project's been going on for over 10 years, but it's a community of individuals who are really looking to live free. So there's no sales tax, there's no income tax, there's no eminent domain, various other, no capital gains tax, various other taxes that just don't apply, inventory tax, et cetera. Or it's a, you know, it's almost, I don't know if you've read Atlas Shrugged, but it's almost, it's as close to, going galt as there is within the United States. And there are, I think, 20,000 people who are participating in that. But they're looking to try it out and see how it works.
Here's the problem with all the laws and regulations and whatnot. It's not that most of the time the government doesn't see this as a way of controlling the people. They look at it as increasing the economy. They're creating jobs by this regulation. We need to grow the IRS, let's say, or whatever other agency to enforce this. Then it creates spin-offs in the private sector that have to deal with this new regulation and policy. And it's created this false economy is how I look at it, that it's built upon lies and scandals and not so far away from liberty and freedom that it's really going to be the downfall of America, that our economy is so wrapped and intertwined around this crap that there's no way to unwind it. And then it's only going to grow and grow into this. And then once the economy crashes, it magnifies that effect. And we can't get back to a self-sustainment society in any sense that's built on hard core infrastructure and businesses that can withstand these tragedies, let's say natural tragedies or warfare or of the such. But it creates a greater America creates a greater society for a time, and that's why it's so easily sold. Like this Modi character saying he's going to put a toilet in every home in India. You know, that sounds great, but it's all such a conglomerate that's based around government that can so easily falter and become corrupt. And it just, the corruption that it just, these systems breed is just, it erodes liberties and freedoms.
Danny and Chelsea, are you guys at all familiar with the territorial system tax?
I am not, actually.
No, I've never heard of that.
I'm going to play a clip here and see. I just want to get the group's feedback on that. It, you know, maybe from a tax avoidance perspective and evasion, it's an interesting idea. So I'm going to roll this clip.
Whether you know it or not, there's a tax barrier to bringing money into the U.S. It sounds strange, I know, but here's how it works. Say you're a U.S. company, and you open up an office overseas to serve British customers. Any money you make in Great Britain is taxed at Great Britain's tax rate, in this case, 25%. And as long as you leave that money in Great Britain, you don't have to pay any more taxes on it. But say you want to bring that money back into the United States. Well, before you can bring that money back to invest in the U.S., you have to pay the difference between England's tax rate and the U.S. tax rate. And since the U.S. has the second highest corporate tax rate in the world, no matter where you're bringing the money from, you're likely to have to pay an extra tax to bring it home to the U.S. In this case, you'd have to pay the difference between England's tax rate of 25% and the U.S. tax rate of 35%. It's almost like paying a toll to bring money to the U.S. And that discourages investment in America year after year. That's money that should be in America. There shouldn't be a penalty for bringing it home. So, what can we do? Well, in addition to reducing our 35% tax rate, the answer may lie in what almost every other developed country has already done. It's called a territorial tax system. In a territorial system, companies only pay taxes on the profits earned here in America. Profits earned in markets outside the United States can be brought home and invested here year after year without that added penalty. If you want to bring that money back for jobs, expansion, research, development, whatever, you don't have to pay any additional tax. That's not all. Right now, U.S. companies are at a disadvantage when they compete for business abroad. Since their international competitors don't have to pay a toll to move their money back home, the U.S. companies have higher costs in everything they do. But switching to a territorial tax system would create a level playing field, letting us win more business around the world. And that's good for our workers here at home. And the increased money invested in the U.S. helps create American jobs and grows American businesses. Just a couple ways switching to a territorial tax system can help the American economy. For more information, visit taxfoundation.org.
What do you guys think about that?
So that's wonderful.
I don't know.
So if I'm understanding correctly, basically the territorial tax system is they only tax income earned within the U.S., then, right? But then it doesn't tax anything. If income is earned from Britain, then it's not being taxed then, so that they can bring it back to the U.S.
Right, right. Yeah, but it seems like to me, and you guys probably know more about this than I do, some of the big multinational corporations that are based in the United States set up corporate offices, specifically in the Netherlands and Ireland, and claim a lot of the revenue there. Which allow, you know, if there was a territorial tax system, they would still, you know, book the revenue in a country with a lower tax rate and then bring it back to the United States, right?
That's my understanding of it. I mean, I've certainly heard about the fact that you can earn money overseas, but then when you bring it back here, you have to pay taxes on it. And I can certainly see that as a disincentive for people to bring their money back here so that they can avoid the double taxation, which is essentially what you get there by not having the territorial form. I mean, if we're constantly wondering about situations, whether it's, you know, sending jobs overseas because we're not providing a competitive environment, you know, whether it's, you know, our minimum wage laws compared to someone else's, or we're allowing people to do international business, but if they want to bring money back into the U.S., therefore back into our economy, that they're being disincentivized to do so, then it would seem to be a very beneficial thing for us to provide incentives for people to bring their wealth back into the United States and therefore help out our economy back at home.
I have a theory. When an American dollar, if you go throughout the world and you spend a dollar in another country, that dollar usually stays there. It never returns to America. But a company, through economics, America loves that to happen, that dollar stays overseas. But when a company does it, the conversion or whatnot, that those dollars will end up staying in that country or will be end up being returned. And so That would be my theory and why such a high tax rate would prevent that money from ever leaving the country then in the first place. And it's not like companies just sit on that money. It's not like, I got $1 million in profit over in this country and I can't bring it back because I'm going to have to pay $350,000. That money stays there and you figure out how to invest it. You hire people and you grow your company through those means. So in the global elitist sense that the global corporations are, I would argue, are part of, that just grows their influence whenever they spread to other countries, and those dollars always, they're able to finagle more and more market share and control of that area.
Well, I mean, they might not be dealing in dollars when they're dealing in international business. I mean, that's kind of a leap as far as I'm concerned.
No, that's what I'm saying. You're dealing in other currencies, and so that's why they're not bringing back that currency here, because since it's such a mass sum, they would have to convert it. And so that sum would always end up just staying in that country anyways.
Well, I mean, we could at least lower. We can make ourselves more competitive. You know, that's never a bad thing.
Oh, no, I'm not saying it's a good thing. I'm just saying the theory behind it is what I suppose.
Oh, gotcha.
I'm not arguing for it, yeah. But I think people should pay as little tax as possible, and it bugs me for how, I mean, I don't agree with the majority of the stuff the federal government spends money on.
You're touching on a good point. To me, I don't mind paying my taxes, but, I'm fine doing that. But I think that when we see people recklessly spending our hard-earned money without really considering what the American people would want our government to spend our money on, that's when I start to get really infuriated and resentful of the tax payment that I have to make, especially when you consider, and I don't have a perfect percentage available right now, but the majority of all of our income taxes go strictly towards the interest earned on the Federal Reserve notes. So we're not even, you know, the majority of our income tax payments aren't even paying for the things that we would expect them to be paying for, like, you know, national defense or schools or roads and infrastructure. It's going to pay back interest on debt that we didn't want, or most people don't even know about it in the first place.
Well, it's because they argue that we need taxes to make a better society. But really, what the tax system is just a form of control.
Well, with all the money that we borrowed, obviously, you know, someone's got to pay for it. And, you know, the U.S. keeps on printing all this money, you know, this interest keeps on stacking up. So, you know, it's, you know, in order to stay liquidity, you know, we have to pay for it to make sure that we still become liquid, that we, you know, we're making all these debt payments timely and that we don't default on this. So, yeah, you're right. We're not paying, we're paying our taxes not to, you know, not for infrastructure. I mean, sure, some of it goes to infrastructure, but a lot of it goes back to the Federal Reserve to make sure that we make our debt payments on time.
Well, they withhold the taxes unless the federal government doesn't give it back to the states or whatnot, unless you do what they say.
Oh, we see that time and time again.
Yes.
So it's really just buying
influence.
There's tax dollars tied to like the Common Core, for example, or more recently in Minnesota, this was within, you know, the last year, basically what happened was the federal government audited our, the way we were spending our Medicare dollars, our federally funded Medicare dollars, and that includes everything from what you would expect to also services for adults with developmental disabilities, for example, and that was my personal intuit. And what happened is they found that the way that they were providing service agreements and dollars that were attached to the individuals that needed it wasn't set up and structured in the way that the federal government approved of. So they basically said, you have to revamp your system now or we're cutting off your cash cow. We're not going to submit any of this federal funding for these adults in need. And the unfortunate part was they gave them this like 6-month window to reform how they were tying these tax dollars to the individuals that needed them. And so the state scrambled to get into compliance. And as a result, we have a system now that has created at least 20 to 40% additional administrative costs to each one of the nonprofits or private for-profit organizations that are currently providing services to the disabled, because they didn't have time to really think about all of the intended and unintended consequences of enacting these changes. So once again, the federal government comes in and says, well, hey, we're pulling the plug. If you don't set up a system that we approve of, your federal funding will be cut. Which is kind of unfortunate considering it's the members of all those different states that are creating the tax revenue within their locality. But because it gets funneled through the federal government, they can then come in and dictate where those dollars go.
That just goes to my argument earlier about that it's a faulty system in the first place.
I don't think anyone will disagree with you there. I mean, I certainly won't.
What's a good possible solution? Is a flat tax one of the better solutions, or are there? Because to me, the tax code is really written in such a way that it benefits business in general through, you know, small business, corporate entities, through deductions and loopholes and that type of thing. You know, what are some of the better solutions to solve that problem?
The fairest way is
the flat tax. I'd say the fairest way is the flat tax. I think it, a lot of people have the view that our tax code benefits businesses, but I would disagree with that. I think that what we see is that it benefits low income individuals. It also benefits people with lots of children. Children are one of the biggest tax benefits you could ever have. And there's really a great financial incentive to have a lot of children. I mean, just overwhelming amount of tax reductions just related to having children, which if you ask me, I don't understand why the government should be involved in that piece to begin with. Your family planning should be part of your budgeting and not part of the American taxpayer dollar, especially if we're going to sit here and say that taxes need to be tied to, you know, like property taxes are tied to the educational facilities within that district. So they'll tie it to homeowners or landowners within a district to pay for the education of children. But at the same time, they're not tying those tax dollars to the people who are using those resources. And so then you see the flip side of that when it comes to taxes in terms of we will financially reward people and subsidize people's choice to have more children. So then on the other side of that.
There's specific reasons for that, though.
And so then on the other side of that, you see more tax incentives for very, very large corporations, you know, the 3Ms or the very, very, very wealthy who have the means to obtain the best tax professionals in the field. So then they're able to find, you know, ways and means within the code in order to reduce their tax liability much lower than was probably intended by the tax code itself. Now, where people really get hit hard and the people that suffer the most from it are people who, A, don't have children or don't have a lot of them and are in more of the middle income range. So the small businesses and the middle income earners, what we're really, really hurting is our middle class and people on either side. So people who are the really high earners will, you know, have a lot to resent, and they tend to point fingers at people who are on the low-income side saying, well, so-and-so didn't have to pay a single dime of taxes. That's unfair. And then the people that are on the lower-income scale will point their fingers at really big business or really wealthy individuals and say, well, they're paying not nearly their share of taxes. That's not fair. But the real victim, as far as I've ever seen, has been really the middle class. And we need to stop pointing fingers, and I think a flat tax would really dissolve a lot of the baloney reasons that people use to point fingers at one another, and it could really solve a lot of the unfair opportunities or tax applications that are within our current system.
Yeah, but we can't go back to the flat tax, obviously. I mean, there's going to be all these corporations and companies and wealthy individuals that, you know, they want more money because, you know, they're greedy. And, you know, they'll find ways of, you know, even if we get rid of the IRS code, you know, they have enough money to find hire lobbyists and, you know, to change the system so then that they don't have to pay the tax. They can write their own rules because, you know, obviously if it favors them, you know, they'll pay the money to lawyers and things like these type of lawmakers to make up these rules. So then, you know, they can take advantage of it and that way they don't have to pay the tax. I feel like even if we get rid of the IRS and then we go back to the flat tax, eventually we're going to have some type of regulation because I feel like there's going to be like a company out there or wealthy individuals that, hey, you know, I don't really want to pay 7% or whatever, let's say 10%. Is the flat tax. I don't want to do that. I'm going to try to figure out a way to not do that. So, and I have the money and I have the power to do that. And, you know,
I strongly disagree with both arguments here.
Would you agree that there's less opportunity for tax evasion in a situation where you have a flat tax? And when I talk about a flat tax, I don't necessarily mean on your income tax returns. What I would more look for would be a flat sales and use tax. So that would be present in everyday transactions instead of one big bill, you know, at the end of the year or coming out of your paycheck. So
right. Well,
if you can't afford to pay taxes on a fancy Porsche, you're not going to buy one. You're going to buy a cheaper car, and therefore your taxes due on that cheaper car are going to be much less and therefore proportionate to your income level.
Well, regardless, there's going to be a sale. So, you know, everyone's going to have to pay the tax, you know. I agree. With a flat tax, you know, we won't be seeing any of these issues with tax evasions and all that. But I don't think that's the issue here. I think it's just that, you know, these people are just greedy and just want to beat the system and they just don't want to pay any taxes. I mean, these large corporations, I mean, 10% is like,
corporations don't pay taxes
because of all these tax deductions and things like that.
Well, it depends on the type of corporation. A C corporation does.
C corporation pays taxes.
But like an S corporation
doesn't. It's worked into the price of the product.
Oh, thank you for bringing this up. Yes. When people think that the corporation, when they speak of the legal corporation in and of itself, not the employees, What people fail to understand is that if you raise corporate taxes, that cost ends up getting passed along, thank you, Kirk, to the price of the product itself, because corporations aren't going to run at a loss. So if they have, you know, $1 million higher tax bill this year, guess what happens? The price of their soap or the price of their tires goes up. So the individuals themselves end up paying for that higher tax rate that's placed on the corporation. And that's what I think a lot of people fail to understand. They might say, oh, we're going to attack the evil corporations who are, you know, just so greedy and horrible. But what they end up doing is screwing themselves over in terms of higher prices for products and services.
Well, either way, the corporations, yeah, they're making up these losses, these tax losses through higher revenues. But regardless, they're still paying the tax.
Yeah,
so
there's
still
cares?
That tax bill. Well, they care. These companies
well,
don't
and I
want
think that we should.
That
we
can
should
I talk
care.
For a second here? Let me explain some things. There is businesses, their taxes they receive are transcended to what they sell or what service they provide. So taxes always hit the employees the hardest. So that's why I disagree with that. It hits the businesses the hardest or whatnot. And the other thing was the children. Since tax is a system of control, not a way for the government to really make money, it's basically all control. So they have to control the birth rate of the population. And our birth rate's so low, we have to incentivize more and more kids. But so that's why I say for how the micromanagement of the tax system, since the form of control, that's how you micromanage it. And that it has to be that way. I mean, our children rate is below 2, which does not replace itself. And it's we're America is going to die away because we're not birthing enough kids. But what I wanted to say was corporations push that tax into their product. All the taxes come from the majority of the people working. And any profits that are gleaned, the government doesn't want to steal all the profits from a corporation. Then the tax, then the stock goes down, then capital gains goes down, and it's a lose-lose for the government because then they don't take the capital gains tax. It's the bottom line is the whole tax system's a fraud. It's we have to look at not what the best way to remedy the tax system. Hang on a second. Sorry, the cop. But our government doesn't even bring in enough money to pay for what it expends anyways in the federal sphere. So it doesn't matter. I could all this tax fraud or whatever. We just go out there and print the money and pay interest on it. And that's an integral part. It has to happen. It can't not be that way. We have to continually grow. No, we can't because of the whole system of the Federal Reserve and the debt-ridden dollar. We have to continually produce more and more debt, and it's a form of a Ponzi scheme in a way that it's going to come to a head at some point because of the mucking of the system and the control. And so that's why I say we don't have the basis, the sound infrastructure of businesses that can withstand this coming ticking time bomb that will eventually occur because of the fractional reserve system and the banking system we have. And so the best way to get around it is to get government back to liberty and out of the people's hair. We have to figure out a way to pay off our debt and stop feeding the beast of the Federal Reserve and the banking system. And Bitcoin is probably the answer. Because Bitcoin makes banks obsolete. You do not need banks.
I completely agree, and that was exactly where I was leading. You almost read my mind. So, you know, in addition to making revisions to our tax code, I mean, those aren't mutually exclusive to having to use the dollar. I mean, we can revise our tax code without participating in a debt-ridden system and the fractional reserve system where we have a private for-profit enterprise controlling how many of monetary units are within the system at any given time or who are controlling the interest rates. Those aren't mutually exclusive, and I'd say that we would benefit from revising both of those systems. So rather than treating Bitcoin as property instead of currency, I think that we could benefit greatly from eliminating the debt-ridden system, the debt-ridden dollar. And when I speak about debt on the dollar, for those of you listening who aren't aware, what I'm referring to is not our debt that we've taken on with China, not our debt that we've taken on with different countries, but the debt that we take on by every dollar that's printed through the Federal Reserve. So anyone listening who doesn't understand or doesn't know or hasn't heard, every single dollar in circulation is growing interest and debt to the Federal Reserve in and of itself, and that's what I was that's what I refer to when I speak about the majority of our debt, because it's not something that goes away. It's not something that we can just pay off, because if we're paying them off in dollars, there's no way for us to escape the accruing interest. And it just seems like a ridiculous system when there are much better options out there that don't involve interest accruing for every monetary unit in the system.
Yeah, but look at this. Look at people don't care anymore. People are so wrapped up in their lives. They're so busy just getting by that they can't fathom a return of liberty and a return of the lack of government intervention and such, that it's people just are so compliant, they just don't care. They don't trust in the political system. They don't see anything really happening. And because of that, government is even being more and more encouraged by that and gaining more and more control. because of it. And it's coming to a head, and it has to. And there's no way to do it other. And then it's just what is going to replace it. And with the trend of government involvement in everything, I mean, everything we hear today is government needs to do something. Government needs to be involved in this. And it's a sad state of affairs. And that's why I was hoping in this podcast we can try and talk about ways around towards liberty. And yeah.
I think we just mentioned two of them. I mean, I think that those are two great things. You know, one, revising the tax code, and then two, finding an exit strategy to the dollar system, which is clearly not beneficial to the American public or the U.S. economy.
Well, revising the tax system is not going to do anything, in my opinion.
They're great ideas, but, you know, what is the practical solution? You know, idealistically, they're great. You know, I agree with it, but it's just that I can't think of any practical ways to make this change.
Well, it's a losing argument. Look how great our lives are.
It is.
I mean, it's hard to argue against it, but it's gonna end up crumbling at some point, and we're not gonna be prepared to deal with it.
Well, I mean, some I think the whole point of us, you know, being on this podcast is to hopefully spread awareness, or at least, you know, some thought-provoking sentiments towards people that might not otherwise be receiving these types of, you know, information or opinions. And we can sit here and make damning comments about the American public at large, or we can be on this podcast and hope that someone might listen, and it might maybe change a decision, or it might help them create a different opinion. Or seek different, you know, modes of news or information, and then that might make some decisions or changes in their lives.
Well, I'm not damning the American public by saying that they're comfortable, and I mean they don't care, because they can't care. They can't. They can only care about their lives and the direction they're going and how everything's tied in together. That it's impossible to escape. And
Kirk,
yeah,
can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Because I was talking and
you're back. Yeah, we could never even hear anything you said then.
It's just as well.
I wasn't talking over you, buddy.
Yeah. One of the maybe it would be good for the last topic on the show here, because we were shooting for an hour and 30 minutes. We may or may not get there. Anyway, Chelsea was alluding to, or actually both Kirk and Chelsea are alluding to Bitcoin as a possible solution for, you know, some of the tax issues. But we can continue talking about this, but one of the topics that I had identified was, net neutrality. So the internet in general, and you know, various ideas and technologies, you know, like Bitcoin and open news sources and that type of thing, you know, could certainly lend a hand to you know, more of an open society, and you know, potentially avoiding some tax schemes and that type of thing. So I have couple clips on. Are you guys familiar with the net neutrality story over the last couple of weeks?
Never.
Might as well talk about it a little bit.
Yeah. So, let's see here. I'm gonna load a few clips here, and this first one kind of gives an overview about what net neutrality is. And another clip goes over what type of legislation is being wrapped around net neutrality. So I'll go ahead and roll the first clip. We can discuss and potentially discuss the second, and then wrap up. How does that sound? Or did I cut off the current conversation a little too soon?
No, it's fine.
All right. Here we go.
Neutrality. A lot of people are talking about it, but there seems to be a lot more confusion than understanding. Here's a quick explanation of what it is and why you should care. The internet is a really complicated hunk of technology, but a super simplified picture is that it works like this. At the top is some large internet provider that carries network traffic. These large companies have organizations as customers, places like universities, corporations, and home internet providers. In turn, these outfits supply internet services to individuals. But what we're concerned with here are these big companies at the top. These are sometimes called Tier 1 providers, meaning they provide internet to customers, but they don't need anybody else to provide internet to them. These big companies are often known by what other stuff they do besides providing internet access. Some are cable television companies, some are telephone companies, others are purely in the business of delivering internet service. When you use the internet, let's say you send an email to your mother, it goes from your computer up to one of these so-called backbones, over to whoever provides your mother with service, and then down through the layers to her computer. The providers handle all the traffic equally. It doesn't matter if you're sending mail, playing an online game, using Facebook, or watching movies, the traffic flows freely. The concern here is that there's nothing forcing them to act this way. See, the internet is basically an anarchy. Not the destructive, chaotic kind, but the beneficial, collaborative kind. It's a global symbiosis. Everybody plays, everybody wins. But there's nobody at the top forcing everyone to play nice. And up until recently, it hasn't been a problem. But what if the cable TV company says, "Hey, we offer online video, but people from other networks can watch the videos. We're basically delivering content for our competition. We should refuse to let this video content pass through our network unless the other providers give us money." Another company says, "We're the telephone company, and people are using the net instead of the phone to talk to each other. Maybe we should block or slow down voice chat." Another provider says to the other two, "Pay us extra money, or we'll slow down your traffic when it passes through our servers." Now, the important thing to remember is that everything I just mentioned is stuff that these providers have actually talked about. As of this recording, they haven't done anything about it, but they have expressed an interest in altering, blocking, or slowing down network traffic that passes through their network, unless somebody gives them money. I said before that the network is symbiotic. The networks deliver traffic for mutual benefit. But the moment a provider starts discriminating their traffic, as soon as they start delivering traffic that benefits them and blocking traffic that does not, they become parasites. That's not hyperbole. They're exploiting an open system to take without giving. Doing so at the Tier 1 level will break one of the fundamental principles of the network, which has been taken for granted from the very beginning. These companies ask, "Why should I deliver your traffic for free?" And the answer is because everyone else delivers your traffic for free. Net neutrality is not a law. It's an idea. It's the idea that all of these providers should simply send and receive traffic without interruption or prejudice. I want to stress that nobody is trying to take away the ability of these providers to make money. If they want to charge extra for video content, they can do what Netflix does, what World of Warcraft does, which is to do business with individuals. If they find that delivering traffic isn't profitable enough, they're always free to raise prices on their customers. But what they're proposing is to alter the flow and behavior of traffic on the network. This would be like a mailman deciding that since he owns the mail truck, he should be able to go through the mail and change or discard any of the mail that he doesn't like. Some people advocate getting the government involved and somehow forcing net neutrality on the providers. Of course, the obvious question is, which government? The network is global, and nobody has the power to make any of these companies do anything with their own hardware unless a law is passed. International governments get along even worse than these companies, and it's possible that having a government in charge of the network is more dangerous to freedom and privacy than a bunch of bickering internet providers. The first solution that might come to mind would be to simply outlaw tampering with traffic at all, but that would make it illegal for these companies to fight spam and other security threats. Actually, making a law that's effective and sensible requires way more technical knowledge than the typical politician can muster. It's entirely possible they might turn to industry experts to help them write these laws, but who do you think those experts will be? The ideal solution, or at least the one that would preserve the prosperity and growth we've enjoyed so far, would be for nobody to seize this power, for the benign anarchy to continue. This anarchy has existed for decades, but now the Tier 1 providers can't seem to control themselves, and some people are adamant that we should head them off with government oversight. So we seem to be left with the choice of having control of the network in the hands of companies or governments. Both of these are less optimal than what we have now. Thanks for watching.
So there's a little bit of a conversation around net neutrality, and I was kind of thinking that it tied in with what we were talking about previously as far as, you know, tax code's concerned, and that's mutualism and non-coercive strategies, and, you know, that type of thing. So I kind of threw this clip in there. You guys have any thoughts on that either way?
Are you for it or against it, Eric?
For what?
For net neutrality.
Yeah, I am certainly for treating all services equally. And that's what net neutrality is.
Well, I don't really see how they can really affect the flow of information and mandate to their own, you know, reduce traffic here or whatnot. I think the internet would figure out.
They do. Definitely can.
It's already starting to happen. Like, so
with Netflix,
and correct me. Yeah. With Netflix. Exactly. Because Netflix is such a threat to, like cable TV. Because cable TV, like, you can spend, what, like, $150 on that a month, or you could pay, like, $7.99 for Netflix. So isn't it true that, is it Time Warner or some of the other companies that have started to throttle Netflix services so it comes through slower?
Yep, Comcast was doing that, and there was a substantial decrease in performance for a few months, and they forced Netflix to essentially pay them money to guarantee a certain level of service. So that was kind of the first example.
Yeah, but let's look at Comcast. They provide the internet. If Netflix is taking up 75% of the internet flow.
No, but at the backbone, at the Tier 1 carrier level, bandwidth is cheap. It's not a rare commodity. It's a cheap and abundant commodity. They set forth with, you know, basically they're trying to protect their interests by rate shaping or prioritizing Netflix traffic at a lower level. So they're artificially degrading the quality of the service to protect their own traffic they ended up getting additional revenue from Netflix to bring it up.
Well, I don't see how they can't be sued for that.
Well, they can do whatever.
I would think that would violate
whatever they want
contracts in the first place, and then
it's their network, though. They can do whatever they want to do.
Yeah, they can just not provide the service at all.
I like the point that he made.
Do that.
Yeah.
It's not their network when we talked about private. Can I just speak for a second? It's not their network per se when the government grants them the license to be in that area.
No, it is theirs. It's their infrastructure. It's completely owned. I mean, it's their property. They can do whatever they want with it.
Yeah, but our government subsidizes them to build in the first place.
No, they don't.
Everything I've read says banks to differ. We talked about this a week or two ago too, but
yeah, no,
I have no way to prove it right now. But I'm
there's
pretty
no
sure there's massive lawsuits, I guess, forming through cities and states that gave subsidies to Comcast and Time Warner to build this stuff, and they haven't at their time frame of what they're going to do. So they said, yeah, we'll create this much speed and this much infrastructure around for your town, this area. And then they go and do the bare minimum. So they're not even backing up to their agreement in the first place. And they were getting subsidies. And it's to me, it's pretty damning for a government to even subsidize in the first place. It prevents competition from other people. And it kind of goes back into the whole muck system of government by it's a system of control. But
as far as net neutrality is concerned, I think that, he made a good point. Instead of going in and regulating this and asking government to intervene and make it a law that tier one providers can't do this, I think it was a good point he made that said, allow these people to, if they want to, if they're finding that it's not profitable, which it sounds like that's not even an issue, but let's just pretend that it was, that they could then raise their internet rates for individual users at home. And then the beautiful thing about free market is that if they do that, that then provides more financial incentive and ease of entrance into the market to maybe provide those services and become a tier one provider. And so the market should be able to self-adjust if we just allow it the freedom to do so.
Well, that's my point. Netflix could have just said, hey, Comcast is doing this to us. Comcast is the reason why your service is lacking right now. You want Netflix? You can't have it because Comcast is screwing with you. We're trying to provide you good service, but they're not. So people would pull out of Comcast and get something else.
They can't, though, because Comcast in a lot of areas is a monopoly.
Yeah, because government intervention have created it. So that's my point, that it's not just Comcast that owns all this stuff. It's there for a reason, and it's allowed to be them through subsidies and whatnot. And that's why I disagree with saying that it's all theirs, and it's it's fascism to me. But it's so this whole U.S. net neutrality is going to stop this somehow. Is that what?
No, net neutrality is the thing that's at risk.
Yeah, I have
another. Naturally, kind of been there since the inception of the internet. Just the idea that when one tier one provider, when you're sending something and it crosses from one provider to another or through a provider, that it's not the services aren't intentionally slowed down or interfered with based on the type of content being provided. That it's just, first come, first serve, a type of deal. And that's the thing that's at stake now that companies are starting to awaken to the idea that they could use their infrastructure to, impose charges on different types of services that might be threatening to their own or might appear threatening to the services that they're providing.
And I have a short 90-second clip that kind of illustrates what you're talking about, Chelsea. I'll play that real quick here.
The following show has been approved as being commercially reasonable for all parties. We just don't know what that means. I'm Adrienne Jeffries, and this is 90 Seconds on the Verge. The internet could be getting a fast lane reserved only for those rich enough to use it. The FCC is considering new rules for internet service providers that would harm a key principle of net neutrality that all traffic should be treated equally. Right now, ISPs aren't allowed to give special treatment, meaning companies like Comcast can't decide if data from Facebook is more important than a movie from Netflix. But the new rules would allow ISPs to discriminate between data on the so-called last mile, where the network connects to your home. It's a toll that would allow ISPs to tax internet companies for connecting with customers who are already paying for the network. All this could be avoided if the government would just declare what most people already take for granted. The internet, like water and electricity, is a public utility. But the major ISPs continue to fight against that label, warning that net neutrality is a meddlesome government regulation. A draft of the Open Internet Notice of Proposed Rulemaking is being circulated to the Commission today, and FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler said that he intends to have enforceable rules by the end of the year. Be sure to let your congressional representatives know how you feel about a free and open internet. And while you're at it, give FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler a call. Here's his number.
We will not let that kind of control take over the internet. Period.
For more on unfucking the internet, check out The Verge. Coming up, Disney World begins offering.
All right, so I don't know if any of you guys have listened to No Agenda lately, but they were saying this net neutrality thing is a bunch of crap and that it's just people you just do not understand and how the internet infrastructure is, that it's the openness and the connectivity of it is self-correcting, and that what these companies do, that what this regulation will do is net neutrality will actually, yeah. it's saying, all right, Netflix, you get this now forever, you know, and it makes any competing thing that much harder to compete because they can't grow into that. And Netflix has the monopoly of it already. And it's just creating this new government regulation that's really going to muck stuff up in the long run. And that whatever these companies, Comcast and Verizon or whoever is doing to Netflix, is really will straighten itself out here. But.
Well, I mean, it doesn't have to be government intervention, and that's not the only option. And the first clip really was asking the question more so than posing the answer as to how do we solve this. And, you know, one side of people would say that we want a government intervention, and another side of people would say that they don't. Net neutrality in and of itself is just to say, you know, there are no tolls that are paid. It's going to be non-discriminatory towards the kind of services that are being provided and where they're going to and from. That is just going to be equal amongst everyone. And that's what we're trying to preserve. But how do we do that? Do we do that in an interventionist way, or do we just hope that it pans out? I mean, it would be highly unlikely if, you know, Comcast or Time Warner is identifying that they can hold certain companies hostage and say, well, we're going to slow down your service unless you pay us money. It's unlikely that will reverse itself naturally. I couldn't anticipate someone just saying, oh, that was great. We made a lot of money off of, you know, holding these different companies hostage. We're not going to do it anymore though, because now we're satisfied. I mean, I don't see that's going to happen. Now, how it does resolve itself is a good question of which I don't have an answer.
All right, let me just read this real quick from, I don't even know what article this is here, but here's a simple question which illustrates in some ways how difficult the regulation challenge is. Should an aspiring competitor to Netflix or any other content or service provider which does not yet have the subscribers or the bandwidth requirements of its competitors be able to force a consumer broadband provider to purchase public peering capacity at parity with whatever private arrangements the broadband provider has made with competitor content or service providers? If the answer is no, they should not, then you are setting the bar higher for the internet as an engine of competition and innovation. The new entrant will have to overcome the market inertia as well as poor quality of service in order to grow. And that will be true of all networks, not just the problematic incumbents, be they monopolistic or competitive.
And there's nothing wrong with having an industry where there are barriers to entry. I mean, that's one of Porter's five forces for a reason. I mean, I don't think that kills competition necessarily. It does make it more difficult for someone to start up in their garage and really get a groundswell. But, I mean, it's not completely against the free market ideal.
Yeah, and a lot of, at least what the FCC chairman said, a lot of the concern around traffic prioritization, at least what they want to regulate within the Federal Communications Commission, are medical and first responder type of activity. So giving, you know, if you have a doctor who's doing a, you know, who's working with a patient via telemedicine or a 911 call that's going you know, over the internet that it gets a higher priority. You know, it wasn't necessarily the idea wasn't to protect, you know, well-moneyed interests like Comcast against Netflix.
To me, that just sounds like the worst idea ever. Then,
what's that?
It's just so easy to argue that way. That, oh, you know, medical emergency, some doctor doing a surgical procedure by robot or something that they get the proceeding over the internet over anyone else. I mean, that's just that's a slippery slope to go down.
Yeah.
It would only devolve into more and more regulation and more control over the internet.
Yeah, and then that kind of goes back to what that initial clip said, is that you need the way that the internet has evolved up to this point, it's been a cooperative anarchy, and you know, imposing regulation only, you know, most likely only degrade quality, and that also, you know, that was one of the reasons why I alluded to net neutrality. That applies to taxation and Bitcoin and money too. If you can have some type of cooperative, non-coercive system that's in place that's outside of state control, that would, you know, from a taxation or currency perspective, it could potentially, prove to be a better system. And, you know, cryptocurrency and other currencies certainly could, you know, they could take advantage of that.
Well, and we see that, you know, any economy or set of individuals are going to thrive under cooperation, as opposed to coercion. You know, that's obviously a better system, and we understand that. Otherwise, we wouldn't be so gung-ho about having a democracy, right? And so why don't we allow our monetary system or our, you know, economic activities to be based on cooperation as opposed to coercion?
Yep, and that is an opportunity that probably will present itself, in the next 10 to 20 years.
Well, I mean, people would just go to the mesh networks too. Did you hear that FCC just is going to grant, I wish I had the exact article or whatnot, but the FCC is going to grant like the 8.3 gigahertz frequency for mesh networks.
Nope.
Wireless transmission.
It's a good future topic.
Which is going to really open up networks, community networks, and it's just going to be everywhere.
Mesh networking. We should touch on that in the future more.
Yeah, it's it'll definitely be. I'll have to do some more research on it.
Yeah.
Hey, would you mind? This might as well play it now. This kind of ties into what we're talking about, that tech collusion.
Yeah, let's do that and then wrap up.
Yep.
So this is a longer clip, isn't it?
No, it's just
Silicon Valley are facing lawsuits.
A minute or two.
A California judge has cleared the way for civil action in a battle between high-tech CEOs and their highly skilled employees. Carter Evans shows us why huge money and the reputation of power brokers are on the line.
Silicon Valley has long been the envy of many in corporate America. Tech titans here offer their employees lavish perks, sprawling campuses, and six-figure salaries. But nearly 65,000 software engineers claim they were unable to jump companies for higher pay because of a series of deals allegedly made by their bosses. Bosses like Sergey Brin and Eric Schmidt of Google and Apple's Steve Jobs.
These were non-solicitation agreements whereby all of these companies agreed secretly not to poach or cold call each other's workers.
A probe by the U.S. Justice Department in 2010 revealed several companies agreed to keep do not call lists and shared confidential salary information to prevent bidding wars. They settled the antitrust complaint, but now Apple, Google, Adobe, and Intel are the target of a civil suit by employees seeking $3 billion in damages.
Their position is we should have made more money, and but for your agreement, we would have made more money someplace else. And that's going to be a difficult thing for the plaintiffs to prove at this trial.
In 2005, Silicon Valley was trying to reboot after the tech crash. Companies pulled their brightest minds on shared projects. Court documents reveal that when Google tried to hire away an Apple engineer, the late Steve Jobs fired off an email to Google saying, quote, if you hire a single one of these people, that means war. After another complaint by Jobs, Google fired the offending recruiter.
Undoubtedly, the biggest villain is Steve Jobs. Without Steve Jobs' force and bullying, I doubt this would have got off the ground. I mean, it becomes clear with just about everybody involved, every CEO who agrees to this arrangement. They understand it's illegal, and they're generally scared of Steve Jobs. And he's not scared of anyone or anything.
But Jobs failed to
face yeah, he's dead.
The Apple. Executive Sheryl Sandberg repeatedly refused to join the non-poaching agreements. Facebook, Apple, and Google declined to comment. With billions of dollars and loads of bad PR at stake, many following the case predict a settlement before next month's trial. For CBS This Morning, Carter Evans, Los Angeles.
How easy is it to pin it on these guys?
Going on here?
Oh man,
there's something going on.
Here we go. Is that the after podcast music party?
That was a, I don't know how that happened. That was a South by Southwest clip. Just kept on going.
Yeah, I've never heard of that before. Have you guys?
Yeah, I heard it. Well, it was a couple, it was a little while ago. And, you know, to be honest, I don't really fault Steve Jobs at all for trying to prevent other companies from poaching his talent. Yeah, I think Google and Apple made a under-the-table type of agreement where they wouldn't steal each other's engineering talent, and that extended out to Adobe and Microsoft. So, I don't know. I think,
yeah, but that's so anti-free market. If you want to hang on to your people, well, you got to pay them more. Then that's the whole essence of the market.
Yeah, it's fixing. It's price fixing, essentially. It is what it was. And
I mean, they were sharing what they paid everyone, yep. So then they knew they could pay equally. And so, oh yeah, you want you really didn't make any more money by going this way, anyways. And that's.
Yeah.
It's that kind of collusion that it happens all the time by business owners in certain fields, but
happens a lot in engineering, especially in Silicon Valley and the IT industry. It's a way of, you know, potentially a way for companies to keep costs down, and it's, you know, there certainly is something to be said for that, but. Yeah.
Why couldn't they just enforce or create? You know, employment contracts. What was to prevent them from using that
non-compete
effort? Yeah, non-compete, and they can write, you know, they can write in there, you know, this employment goes from this date to this date, and, you know, you can't go to our competitor, blah, 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 right. You know, and then the person chooses that whether or not to sign that contract, and maybe they shop around before they take the job.
There's just some petty infighting. You know, at a higher level within organizations that, you know, like what you're saying, Chelsea, that makes sense. But
well,
sometimes emotional responses don't make sense, right?
Well, research and development, all that stuff is under lock and key. I mean, it's pretty damning to have a developer or something that knows some inside information to go work for your competitor. So,
yeah. And that's really, I think, you know, as far as Jobs is concerned, he's protecting his
you know, star employees or want to keep them and not have them poached and give up that intellectual property to a competitor. That's what those guys are most concerned about. And it happens a lot.
So we're all just slaves to the owner of the company then?
Well, I mean, exactly what somebody said earlier. I mean, if you want to keep good talent, then you got to keep them happy, you know. So whether that's through their compensation package or fringe benefits, I mean, there are whole fields of study based on compensation management that teach executives how to motivate their employees and how to create higher retention rates.
And I think part of the conversation around this clip are various executives just getting upset by other companies just paying far above the market rate to poach their employees with a lot of intellectual property. That, you know, that's probably...
Well, if that's an issue, then their competitors are either going to have net losses because they're paying such high wages that they can't cover their costs, or they're going to find that they're still profitable even though they're paying higher wages because the intellectual property or the intellectual results that come to fruition as having the best talent provide them with enough profits to more than compensate for the higher salaries. So then that will either allow their competition to either raise salaries or, you know, the higher salaries resulting in a net loss will then actually hinder their, you know, competition. It's the free market at work, and I think that given enough time, if you allow the free market to work, it will just sort itself out.
Yeah. Well, I just think it shows the nature of our government that this kind of stuff is allowed in a way. I mean, this kind of stuff is highly illegal, and yet it seems to be semi-commonplace in a sense, but I mean, wages have not been to collude in this. It's to collude in keeping, you can't hire any other to limit the competition. And that it's definitely illegal. They just said it was illegal in the article. They all know it's illegal.
No, I'm asking. I'm not suggesting that it's not. I'm asking because I'm apparently missing something. I don't understand how it's illegal. If I'm a business owner and I go to one of my competitors and say, hey, come on, guy, don't hire any of my... I mean, I don't think that it's ethical.
That's not illegal.
But if you could point to the actual law that shows me that it's illegal, I would like to see that.
Yeah,
and I'm not saying that it's not there. I'm just saying I don't know what it is.
I don't know the specific law either, but... It's highly legal for how the system's set up.
Illegal and unethical are two different things.
It's not unethical,
but it's definitely illegal.
It's not illegal.
Well,
I
would like to see where that is illegal because I can't think of a single employment law where that would be considered illegal.
We'd look at it and say that from a moral viewpoint, it's wrong.
Replay the article. They just talked about how it's all legal. It's going to court. It's been settled on the previous court, and now it's going to get settled again because it is illegal. The lady was spinning it, saying it's going to be hard to prove that any of these employees didn't make any more money because of this illegal act. If it was based on illegal or not, then it'd be a case closed. They have to prove that they were harmed.
Illegal, but if they're saying that I lost out on earnings because of somebody else, that's like saying that someone monetarily damaged me because I was unable to, receive wages that I would have otherwise had. Saying that they basically damaged me financially by these actions, which doesn't say that what they were doing specifically is illegal. It's just that if you financially damage someone and you can prove that this person financially damaged you, then they might be subject to paying that back. So that's an entirely, I know it's kind of complicated to look at it that way, but that means that their actions in and of themselves weren't necessarily illegal, but if you financially damage someone else, then, and you can prove this is how many dollars I don't have in my pocket because of their actions, then that's how they're going through the court system, saying that they've been financially damaged.
Yeah, because now it's in the civil court. This is a civil. The legality of the issue at hand was settled before it even got a ruling on it because they wanted to have a ruling on it. It was highly illegal what they were doing, and it got settled before it ever.
I'll just leave it at that.
That was the article that we just played. The first part was about how it.
I mean, show me the law. That's all. I just want to know what law they're breaking.
Yeah, my thought is they're not breaking any type of law, but morally it's a questionable practice, right?
Absolutely.
Look at CEO pay compared to employees' pay.
Yeah.
Those are all structured pretty equally. And if the employees are that relevant to the structure of the business, they should be compensated as much as well, and it shouldn't be repressed to prevent the profits being made to keep it in the whatnot. But
I just don't like when people get down on, compensation structures of large organizations, saying that, the people on the ground are making, 1% of what the CEO is making. You know what? If you don't like it, work somewhere else.
Yeah,
hold on just a second. Let me finish, please. A certain part of the compensation that you have to consider. So, like, I started my own company a year ago. And you know what? 20 years from now, I'm going to be making a heck of a lot more than the people on the ground floor. But you know what else I'm being compensated for? I took a risk. I took a risk that no employee
will
ever take. I provided them a job. They didn't have a whole lot of risk involved. And you know what? I think I should reap the rewards from that. So I don't think it's a demonizing thing to say that, a CEO or a company, owner, it's morally wrong or, systemically wrong for them to be making a higher proportion of earnings.
I'm not arguing that. I'm saying go back and look 10, 20, 30 years at the compensations for CEOs' rates and how they have continually risen with inflation and whatnot. And then go back and look at the workers' wages and tell me they haven't been repressed, and it's being repressed through this kind of collusion. And it is creating this income gap that's creating the Democratic Party because of the outrage of the working class. That's eroding more and more freedom, which benefits the CEOs because they're in more and more control. It's a damning system. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with what CEOs make. I'm saying that people's wages have been repressed and were taxed more, and it's creating this slave mentality that, you work for this company, you need a... You're stuck there, I guess, and you can't go and find your top three competitors that would all hire you. You're so qualified for. You can't go and figure out how to make more money.
Well, I your own.
I think we should talk for a second about. Do you guys like how this? How we've been flowing this way the last 2 weeks of clip. We'd rather do it off here, or
off here.
It'd be fun to do it.
Let's wrap it up, Kirk. And
all right. Well, this has been an exciting evening. Again, thanks for listening. This is Liberty Southwest, episode 12, and we'll see you next time.